Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. My guest today is Jim Linnell. He's a writer, teacher, and director, and is professor emeritus in the Department of Theater and Dance at the University of New Mexico. He's also former dean of the College of Fine Arts. Linnell helped establish the MFA degree in dramatic writing at UNM. In 2012, he was 6 months from retirement when he went on a family vacation on Mexico's Baja Peninsula for his son's 40th birthday. Linnell went out at night for a walk with his wife and fell off the front porch, fracturing the bones in his neck. It left him a quadriplegic. But it was an incomplete spinal cord injury, and doctors gave him a 2-year window to regain function in his limbs. His new book, Take It Lying Down, chronicles his life since the accident. I asked him to read a passage about being flown back to Albuquerque and then to Craig Hospital in Denver for rehabilitation.
When we flew out of Cabo, we flew past a land formation called El Cajon del Diablo, or the Devil's Drawer. As we fly out of Albuquerque toward Denver, we fly past mountains named Sangre de Cristo, the devil mashed against the blood of Christ. It feels like a Hieronymus Bosch painting. My body feels like a scene with the devils dancing around a fiendish device constructed by Christianity's fever dream of sin and its consequences. I am crammed into a drawer made of wire mesh. My nose sticks through a gap on one end and my toes poke out on the other, my body tied naked inside. My skin mimics the feeling of devils hopping about with buckets of hot coals and chunks of ice that they throw on top of the drawer, while one jiggles it so that they drop through the wire gaps. An old crone dances a spastic jig, carrying a sharp stick she erratically jabs into my left shoulder. When we learn I'll be at Craig for 3 months, I realize Jennifer, too, is being tossed in a drawer. The woman of constant motion will have her life seized as if a solemn devil has her in its grip. Her body arches, legs flail as she is pushed down, while another fiend pours tar into the open drawer, sticking her to the bottom. Suddenly pulled from her world and our life together, she is bound to my journey. You would have to be superhuman not to think of it as a kind of hell, despite every effort to hope, to deny, as she faces the loss of my animate vitality. I am familiar. It is my 6'1" body, the face she's kissed, the arms and hands that held and touched her. It is the dreamy guy who worked as frantically in the yard as she, and who procrastinated until she had a fit. I do everything you ask me, quick, quick, just like that. And what about you? Not so quick, quick, huh? There he is and is not. Is he lost or dead? Yet he is right there needing her. It makes grieving complicated.
How did you cope with that complete loss of autonomy?
There's no way to describe what it's like to not be able to move your body. I mean, period. You just can't do anything. And you are in suddenly a strange place where I went was in total denial. This is terrible. I can't think about it. I won't think about it. To be faced with total life change in an instant, like a random moment in time, it's impossible to instantly have an answer to that. It took us weeks to be able to think about it. And when we did, my wife and I never talked about it because I couldn't talk at first. Took us like 3 weeks at Craig before we could even sit in a room and talk about it. Mm. And then we didn't have the words to talk about it. Why could you say to your wife, I just ruined your life, sweetheart. We're about to go into retirement nirvana and travel and do all these wonderful things. And now the slate has been wiped clean. We didn't know what was going to come.
Your details are extensive, and you wrote journals each week, and you shared it with your friends and family. Did this become a way to fight back against the despair?
Indeed, it was. At some point in the hospital, if you have any illusions that you're not in deep, really deep What they first do to you is they show you this lift system around the bed. You know, I'm 180 plus pounds. How do you manipulate a man who cannot move at all? They have this incredible lift system with a sling, but the minute you get put in it, you just realize you're just like a big sack of grain, and there's no, if you had built up in your mind some little hope things are going to get better, you go into that sling, get moved around into a chair or into the shower chair, you just, you know, that hope is taken away from you. One day I just asked Jennifer, can you type for me? I think I'm going to start writing reports. You know, I was dean. I knew a ton of people on campus. I had a lot of friends, and they kept wondering what the hell's going on with me. So I decided to start writing weekly reports. And it wasn't just that. It was just the act of sitting with my wife and being able to say, what just happened to me this week? What did I just do this week? What do I feel like? How do I say what I'm going through emotionally and what's happening to my body? That was a sense of control, a sense of autonomy when I had no physical autonomy. And then the people in Albuquerque were just fantastic. People started to share my reports, and I got the sense, oh, God, I now have an entire community. I have a cheering squad. You know, nobody's immune to the chariots of fire effect. People are rooting for you. You can't just then say, lay on your ass and do nothing. You know, people are hoping you'll come back and you'll fight through it. So it was a huge boost to my willpower, because nothing feels good when you're trying to rehab with a wrecked body like that.
You make numerous, of course, given your background, numerous literary references throughout the book, including one about Connor McPherson's play, The Seafarer, where a character is playing poker with the devil for his soul. Why did this seem particularly relevant to what was happening to you?
Two things about the scene that I loved. One is the fact that the devil thinks he's won the hand. If he wins the hand, he gets this character's soul. But somebody's forgotten their glasses. They're Irish. They're all drinking. They're all talking. They're all distracted from one thing and another, not paying attention. And suddenly they do. Somebody finds their glasses. And it's just the chaos of human beings undoes the devil's plan to snatch this poor guy's soul. Plus, the devil has the most insane description of hell I've heard in a long time.
It was pretty horrible.
But it's not so different from what you feel trapped in your body that doesn't move. He describes a person in a coffin, basically, in which he's under the sea and nothing can move. It goes on for a whole page. It's horrendous, the description of what it's like. But it's, you know, you relate in my position.
And the thing about the description, it gives Dante a run for his money, I will say, is the sense of not only not being able to move, of isolation and aloneness.
Yes. Well, hell is not only being stuck in that thing, it's being cut off from anybody's ability to interact with you.
You make a lot of literary references to Dickens, William Blake, paintings by Hieronymus Bosch. Did those help, or did they reinforce feelings of despair?
You know, you say to yourself, well, I'm glad I got some kind of education that's useful. And it turns out it's useful. Those references meant something to me, that it would help me to describe the situation that I was in. And it made me feel like I was doing what I was trained to do. I was trained to be a teacher, and in the background of literature. So being able to use that to describe who I was at that time and what was happening to me was a pleasure.
You particularly find some comfort in the notions of suffering in Greek tragedies. Why?
Yeah, the Greek tragedies are unique in the sense that they created a kind of cultural revolution equivalent to Copernicus in the cultural field, in that they moved art away from religion into the civic world, into the human world. So they took what character who was to be a hero and devastated that character's life. But unlike Shakespeare, who would leave him dead lying in the stage, was stuck with a sword or whatever, the Greeks didn't leave the character dead. They left the character to continue on with their life. And the Greeks had a sense that suffering was an integral part of woven into the fabric of what it makes you to be human. And to see a person brought low and to continue on was essentially a sense of freedom against what we know is the random chance of terror that will happen to any human being, whether it's accident, war, disease, whatever. We're never far from the chance to be world champion sufferers.
You write that, I love this part, it's hard to imagine the blind Oedipus wandering in exile with his daughters encountering this culture. Before he knew it, he would be outfitted with a cane, enrolled in a support group, have his diet checked and improved, and be given books on tape about living a full life. How did framing the absurdity of your day-to-day struggles help?
To be able to laugh is essential. You know, it's essential to make you feel this hope. It makes you feel alive. A person in that situation has to decide, is my life going to be about suffering, or is my suffering going to make me more attached to my life? If you want to stick with your suffering and that's all you want to pay attention to, that's your choice, but it's a tough one. Life offers everything still, no matter how much you suffer. It's all still there. The beautiful world we live in is still right there.
If you just joined us, this is University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm talking with Jim Linnell about his book, Take It Lying Down. Linnell is the former dean of the College of Fine Arts at UNM and professor emeritus in the Department of Theater and Dance. His book chronicles his struggle to regain movement in his limbs after a fall in 2012 left him a quadriplegic. When you left the Denver hospital, they basically gave you a 2-year window to make improvement. How did your wife, Jennifer, motivate you to keep moving, even if it was painful, even when you didn't want to?
You have to meet Jennifer to understand. Jennifer's a former professional dancer, no stranger to the physical pain of the body, and could eat it for lunch. So she had limited sympathy for my whining about this is too hard, this is too much, you know, because you do exercises, lift higher, move, do this, do that. She, along with the incredible culture at Craig, removes from your vocabulary, or at least when you're around them, the word I can't. And she was just by her own force of belief. How would I want to disappoint this woman whose life I just nearly ruined?
Just as you're getting better with more movement, your insurance company, decides you have had your allotment of therapy.
Yeah,
so how did you keep going?
Well, you know, money in the bank helps. We had resources. Not everybody was as lucky as I was, because I had those resources. We could go pay for a Pilates instructor who turned out to be a huge piece of my recovery. Colleen Cummins, which runs a Pilates studio here in town, began working with me then and has worked with me ever since. But insurance companies don't recognize the value of Pilates, despite the fact that Joe Pilates, who created this field, rehabbed soldiers from the war and brought them back into some sense of abilities with their bodies. But yeah, and it was crazy. The insurance company says, well, you got 10 PT sessions. And I have a permanent spinal cord injury. It's not going to be fixed. And 10 sessions with PT. So yeah, we had to do something different.
You write that you struggled when you went home with how to grieve the person you lost.
The person that came back from Craig to the house that was there was not the person that had lived in that house. There is a sense of mourning and grieving you have to do that that person's gone. That's just not going to come back. And so you have to say to yourself, well, from now on, now I just have to think what I'm doing is building new memories. You're going to be a new character, a new kind of character, and everything that happens now will be different, but it'll be memories of the new person you're going to be. But everything you see in the house reminded me, of course, of the person that I was, and that took some time to work through.
You made remarkable progress in the two-year window the doctors gave you to improve, and you had many people helping you, Jennifer, your wife, your sons, therapists, healthcare workers. When you went back to the rehab hospital in Denver to sort of gauge your progress, none of the researchers seemed interested in how you got so far in your improvement. Why?
I was so pissed off. I came back like the kid that, you know, look at me, I'm the head of the class. I went back to what they call is the what's happened after a year. I was the only guy there in a walker. By that time, I was using a walker. I had fought my way out of the wheelchair through a variety of steps, and I was there in a walker, only one there. And all of the people that are dealing with me said, oh, my God, that's fantastic. How wonderful. And so I said, well, why don't I go and talk to your research arm? And they must be interested in how did he do this? And so I first talked to a quantitative researcher, and he said, oh, I'm sorry, but you're an N of one. You're only one person. We can't deal with that kind of thing. Let me send you to the qualitative researcher. I said, perfect. As with everybody I met, the first question they asked, well, when did this happen from your accident? I said it was in the two-year window. And just when I said that, the light went out of their eyes and they just turned off. I don't know if they thought there was some magic to the 2 years, because it didn't feel like magic to me. So the qualitative researcher did the same trick. I told her the 2 years, and she just, like, withered up and had no interest in what did I do, what things did I do, what exercises, what PT.
Acupuncture,
what? Yeah, there's a wonderful man here in town named Jason Howes, a miracle worker. He and I hooked up early on, and he worked with me along with Colleen. They weren't interested in any of that. They didn't want to know. You would think that people like me that would want stories about this, that they should at least collect stories. We'll have this website. These are stories of what people did. Check it out. See what they do. None of that. They weren't interested in any of that.
I mean, it seems clear to me reading the book that if someone hadn't had your resources or your circle of support or people just saying, no, you will not do these exercises today, you wouldn't have gotten as far as you did.
If I had just sat in the power chair and done nothing, there was no way in hell. So you can't not work your body. If your body is ready to do something, if there's no effort to sort of keep your muscle tone going, you can't make use of it when it's there. So it's nuts to think that you aren't interested. You shouldn't be interested in the various things people have tried to do.
You write about the tension between you and your wife, Jennifer, and you end with a phrase, in everyday life, simplicity and directness leave heart space for the freewheeling beings we love and the stories that form around us. What did you mean by that?
You have to learn it's like a new comedy of manners. I'm the helpless one. It's a tremendous shift of power between a couple. You know, if you worked out how your things are working with each of you, you take care of this, you take care of that. Now you take care of jack crap. And she does everything. And you're in this situation where you might want this to happen or you need this. And you get into this crazy sense of mind, I need this now. I need this now, you say to yourself. And then you have to realize, well, buddy, you can't do it. Somebody's going to have to do it for you. So shut up and be patient. Because if you start yelling at the person that's going to do it for you, pretty soon she's not going to be wanting to be around you. No, it's a whole new way of civility. It's essential. It's profound, actually, I think, that you have to make space for the other person to be what they need to be and see that you are making the effort to be a partner in this enterprise and not just to be a needy, quiny individual. And it takes a lot of patience, and you need to give the other person the space to live their lives.
This is University Showcase on KUNM, and I'm Megan Kamrick. My guest is Jim Linnell, former dean of the College of Fine Arts at UNM and professor emeritus in the Department of Theater and Dance. In 2012, while in Mexico celebrating his son's 40th birthday and just 6 months away from retirement, Linnell became a quadriplegic after falling off a porch on a rental house. His book, Take It Lying Down, chronicles his life since the accident and his quest to regain his physical independence. What I also found interesting, because you did some cognitive therapy while you're getting all the other therapy to come to terms with what happened in your life, and it seemed like it helped you come to some resolution with unresolved things with your parents.
It did. Writing this, the book is not only a clinical description or description of just the work of Craig. I tell the story of my life of who was the guy that fell off the porch. And that includes, of course, who my parents were. So I had to think through again my relationship to my parents. My mother committed suicide at a really young age. She was 59. And it's something I never really integrated much. I was always angry about it and unhappy. So I had fogged up my whole window through which I looked at my mother. So this having to go write about both of them and their lives and who they were and how I felt about them, this book really sort of cleared a lot of that up for me.
Why did you find so much resonance in Samuel Beckett and his play Happy Days? You talk a lot about that near the end.
Because if you're in the body that I am in, you don't want anybody telling you happy talk. And if anybody is not interested in happy talk, it's Sam Beckett.
That's an understatement.
So he's the guy that's going to tell you, yes, this is our life is like the fact that I chose Happy Days because the woman is buried up to her. First up to her torso in this dirt mound and unable to move. And this whole sense of the affliction of life and the suffering that it brings is such a powerful topic of Beckett's that it seems like a natural writer for a guy like me.
The accident was about 6 years ago, is that right?
Seven
years ago. So you came in here today. You drove yourself, came in on a walker.
I did.
You can move both your arms.
I can.
How are things for you now?
The place that I got to after those 2 years has not budged much. My life would be fantastic in comparison to what it is now if I could get rid of spasms.
Yeah, you write about those a lot.
Spasms are part of a spinal cord injury because of the crazy messaging that goes between the various parts of your body to your brain, and the interruption in the with the injury spot in your spinal cord. The spasms are the hardest part of. It's like some little nasty animal is gnawing on your ankle when it happens. So if it would happen now, I would carry on with you just as I am now. And part of my brain is suppressing the fact that the spasm is bothering the hell out of me. I can go to a dinner with friends and I can be spazzing away with one leg and still be part of the situation, but it takes great. It takes more energy out of your brain to do that. Wakes me up at night. It bothers me during the day. So the function that I have would be great to greater in terms of overall well-being, darkened significantly by the constant spasming that I get.
How have you and Jennifer shifted your retirement life?
Well, she's the girl she's always been. She's been pushing for us to go to Europe again. We went to Norway mm-hmm. on a cruise, and we're talking now about going back this summer, and one of our sons is another birthday event. Hopefully there's nothing cursed about birthday events. But we might meet up with one of our boys in Barcelona this summer. So, yeah, we're still trying to, you know, we're in our late 70s, both of us. The window is, no matter how physically this or that is going on, the window, you can see the opening narrowing in terms of what you want to get into your life. You better get about it.
I wanted to, and if you could read, there's a passage, page 181.
You want me to start there?
Yeah.
That one bad thing happens does not change the fact that one good thing happens. That these circumstances occur next to each other by seconds. There is no logic or belief that makes sense of this. There is only persistence, patience, and the wonder of our connection to others who miraculously love us as we love them. Is this enough to keep us in the game? A game we know has no certain rules?
Have you found the answer to that?
Well, for me it has. For me it is. I've always treasured friends, but they're even more significant now. The richness of what friendships bring to your life, what other people bring to your life. But still, it's just the living in the world doesn't go away. You're still in the world. You're breathing the air. You're out in nature. And you're either going to collapse inward and think it all is a plot against you and hurl insults against those that brought this terrible thing to you, or you realize there's nobody to hurl at. There's no insult big enough that would undo what's happened, and there's nobody to hurl it at.
Well, Jim Linnell, thank you so much for coming and talking with us.
Yeah, I love talking to you, and it's a pleasure to be able to let people know about this. And, you know, people have all kinds of suffering. I'm in no unique position, but if this book helps anybody, I'll be thrilled.
Thank you so much. That was Jim Linnell, author of the new memoir, Take It Lying Down. He's the former dean of the College of Fine Arts at UNM and a professor emeritus in the Department of Theater and Dance. He'll be doing a public reading from his book on August 22nd at Bookworks in Albuquerque. You can find more about that at KUNM.org. That's also where you can find all our previous interviews. Thanks to Associate Professor David Bashwinner for composing our theme music. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to University Showcase.